Good day, good evening, and good streaming. I am Jello Biafra, and this is Renegade Roundtable. Tonight, and I do emphasize night, because no matter when you're listening, watching, whatever, tonight we are going to Noir Alley. Yes, the guest is the Noir Alley guy, as a lot of you know him. There we go. Even got my Richard Widmark tie on from Kiss of Death. His greatest ever role. His first role, and it got him an Oscar nomination. Anyway, besides Noir Alley, you go to his website, and there's three of them, as it turns out. It is described as a word slinger, impresario, and of course the czar of noir, also responsible for the Noir City Film Festival in the Bay Area and now other places, the Film Noir Foundation. And there's a website for that. There's a website for Noir City and eddiemuller.com. We've got nonfiction, novelist, playwright, director, and more. Here we go. The czar of noir himself, Eddie Muller.
Jello, thank you for inviting me to be on your podcast. I appreciate it very much.
Well, good, good. I really appreciate you coming. I mean, not too many people know I'm such a sucker for these movies and everything. I even dressed up for you, and then here you are on the screen, and you got a jeans jacket on.
Yeah, I know, and I wear denim. I know. You put on a suit. Well, not a suit, but at least you have the shirt and tie. And I went with the denim, and I've got like I don't know what, but this is, I'm at home. I mean, I'm in my home office, and once in a while I have to give it a rest, from working the persona of the czar of noir. But listen, before we start talking, and I'm very enthused about doing this conversation, but I want to tell people that you have been a charter member of the Noir City Film Festival crowd from the very beginning, from the first one we did at the Castro Theater in 2003. You have always been an attendee and a supporter of the Film Noir Foundation. So while it may come as a surprise to some of your loyal fans that you're a noir head, like so many of the rest of us, it is hugely appreciated because you don't just talk the talk, you walk the walk, my friend.
I didn't have time to go find a jacket to put on, so I dashed over here, and we're still recording a little bit late, but at least it's nice, easy evening for both of us here.
Absolutely.
And bridge traffic wasn't too horrible anyway. So what created you?
What created me? What a great question. I think a confluence of factors. I think I am unquestionably my father's son. I realize now that I am sort of following in my father's footsteps because he was a sports guy. But the way that all played out for him professionally, I feel like I have followed in his footsteps in that regard because he was like considered, like an expert in what he did. And he would get, phone calls in the middle of the night from people who wanted him to settle a bet about a boxing match or something. And now I get those calls or emails. Pardon?
He was a sports writer, correct?
Correct. He was a sports writer for the San Francisco Examiner when that was known as the flagship of the Hearst Empire, right? And we can certainly talk about that. But that's partly what created me. Also, the 60s kind of created me because I had a bit of a backlash to the whole... I mean, I was born in 1958, and so I was very impressionable.
San Francisco, right? You grew up in San Francisco too, right?
I did. I grew up in San Francisco. And so, the whole 60s movement, the whole Summer of Love thing and all that, the airplane and the Dead and all of that, that was right there in front of me. And quite honestly, I was very resistant to it. I was not a flower power kind of guy or anything. It kind of pushed me in a different direction. And while I have, at this point, I have no, you know, huge antagonism toward those years, I realized that my, like I say, it pushed me in a different direction. And so I was kind of more into what San Francisco was like prior to the Haight-Ashbury and all that stuff. And now I see it as one big continuum, but I don't know. I mean that, you know, and then dialing for dollars, what, you know, cutting school to watch movies in the middle of the day, that also helped create me.
Well, so did you get decent grades at the end of the day, or did you not?
I was not a particularly good student. I found that I was one of, I don't know what I was looking for necessarily, but I connected with certain teachers more than I connected with subjects. So if it was civics or anthropology or English or something like that, I found I did very well. If it was science and mathematics, I didn't do as well. And that was entirely, I think, because of the teachers. I find that science and mathematics teachers are not as communicative, and it's not as easy to connect with them as it is with social studies teachers and English teachers, who are much better communicators, if that makes sense. Was that kind of your experience?
Well, I also had very influential speech and drama teachers. I mean, the middle school guy, junior high, as they called it then, he liked mutant kids. My good friend John Greenway, I grew up with, who basically was the classic smartest kid in the school no one could control. And he was getting almost straight Fs by the time we were in eighth grade, but he got an A in the speech class because he enjoyed the assignments. He liked geography too, and the teacher was a native of Oxford, Mississippi, with an accent just like Lindsey Graham named Van Alessandro.
Wow, that's Faulkner Town, Faulkner territory.
He preached on Sundays, and he was very much a fundamentalist Christian, but he didn't force that on people, which was a really good thing for me to learn clear back then. So I didn't view everybody as like these rabid bigots that so many, right, many of the ones who get on screen tend to be. But, you know, he the assignment on advertising, John did a brand he made up of marijuana, and I think he got an A for that. And then when you're supposed to read a poem to the class, I read Dead Babies, the lyrics to an Alice Cooper song. Wow, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
So then he also directed the play, so that kind of coaxed me out of my shell for that, and I got the Boris Karloff role in Arsenic and Old Lace in the spring. And you know, both he and Barbara Moore, the one I had in high school, they were both method directors, and we did real plays, and they were very demanding. So I got a lot out of that went into my own not just stage, but also my writing, not just music, lyrics, but the music. The words have to fit the atmosphere. You can't switch the lyrics to Moon Over Marin and Nazi Punks Fuck Off and have either song work very well. And so he'd be, and even my engineer for many years, Matt Kelly, told a studio magazine once that he, dealing with me in the studio is more like dealing with a movie director than a musician, you know, because I acted as producer from Frankenchrist onward for everything except the Lard album. So I didn't realize for years how much the method acting training influenced my lyrical style, lots of you are there type mm-hmm. stuff, instead of sloganeering and everything. You know, instead of another anti-nuclear bomb song, do Kill the Poor from the Pentagon's point of view, and goes on and on from there, of course. So yeah, did you have any forensic speech or drama teachers? You did not do drama that in high school.
I didn't really do drama in high school because that wasn't my interest. I was interested in film without question. And in the San Francisco Unified School District, when I was in, I'm trying to remember exactly the years that I was in high school, but which I don't think I can remember. But I do recall that I took a film literacy course, which was the very first one ever offered in the San Francisco Unified School District. And it was an interesting saga, because I was kind of a dick. I'm going to admit, I was kind of a dick when I was in high school. And I just was so wound up in my own stuff that I was so deeply into, and film was one of those things. And so
what
when
about
this
music, what are you listening to music wise?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it wasn't until I left high school and went to the San Francisco Art Institute that's when the whole punk explosion happened. And that's when, you know, I was at the Art Institute with Penelope and when the Avengers were formed and that's when you were doing all your stuff at the Mabuya Gardens. But when I was in high school, I had this teacher who really tried his best. And it's one of the regrets of my life that I was terrible to this guy. I'm not sure why. It's just because the way you are when you're an adolescent, you know. And we made a film. We made a film as the school project. And I kind of wrote and directed this film, but it was just like a little mini Hollywood saga in high school, because I was like the Orson Welles and he was like the studio boss who took everything away from me. Yeah, because he said you're kind of dominating the whole process and it needs to be shared amongst the class. And you know, I nowadays that would be obvious. It wasn't so obvious back then. So he was probably right about all of this, and I was trouble. I was kind of trouble for a lot of teachers, but I say that now because I kind of regret that I put them through the grinder. But there were other teachers who got me totally and were very, you know, I had to have letters of recommendation written when I wanted to go to art school, and you know, because you're not supposed to go to art school right out of high school. And I did, and I got several of my high school teachers who wrote me letters of recommendation. You know, that's just, you asked, I'm just telling you honestly, that was sort of my experience. I somewhat regret it. I wish I had been nicer to these people, but you don't know that when you're a teenager.
Yeah. Did you ever go back and visit any of them?
Well, it was very interesting. Years later, you may recall, I did some work with a local theatrical troupe called the Thrill Peddlers.
Oh, yes.
We did Grand Guignol plays at a venue called the Hypnodrome in San Francisco. And
we got to define Grand Guignol too.
Grand Guignol was a theater of terror that was created in France in the early part of the 20th century. And my dear colleague, Russell Blackwood, thought it would be wonderful to revive Grand Guignol Theater, because it was all about reflecting the horrors of contemporary society to an audience in an entertaining fashion. And the essential thing about Grand Guignol Theater is they would do multiple one-act plays in a night. But when the play started, you had no idea whether it was going to be funny or whether it was going to be horrifying. and that was our modus operandi. And one of these nights, my film literacy teacher showed up at one of the performances because he had seen it written up in the local paper and knew that I was involved. And so he was the one who came out to sort of make peace, if you will, after all these years, like, hey, glad to see you're doing something creative and all that, which I really, really deeply appreciated. Yeah. And so we at least did have a nice conversation and sort of, you know, it's the way it's supposed to be. Like, and I told him that, you know, I sort of got my start doing this stuff in your class, even though I was a prick. And I'm glad we had that moment because he passed away a couple of years after that. So
Van Alessandro came to a Dead Kennedy show the one time we played in Boulder. And what did you think, Van?
Well, I like the fact that you've put all those teacher imitations to good use. I wish you quit picking on my buddy Reagan.
Well,
but that was a matter of, you know, he knew how to agree to disagree. I mean, he let out that he really thought Jerry Falwell was cool too. And I kind of, okay, well, you can imagine what I think of that, Van. And then we go on, and he came to my mother's 90th birthday party, and that was fun. I mean, they liked each other anyway. So that was a nice treat. And he showed up unexpectedly at a memorial service for my younger sister, when she and her husband were killed in a mountain climbing accident, Rocky Mountain National Park. And of course, being an accomplished Sunday preacher and whatnot, he spoke beautifully. Mm-hmm. And I was so glad to see him there. And oh my God, his toupee's gone. So we've kept roughly in touch. He never went to one of my spoken word shows. Another really good teacher I had for American literature right before I left high school early, because I had all the credits. He came to a spoken word show, and it's kind of like back in the 60s, all this stuff you're saying.
Yeah, so, but I mean, isn't it nice that when you can deal with these people face to face later on and sort of, you know, make amends or whatever needs to be done? It's like, but that can only really happen in a, you know, personally, like face to face. This is why I have so much trouble with social media and the fact that people, you know, become virulent enemies through social media. And it's like, well, if you actually had the time to sit down and, you know, talk to each other, you don't have to agree, but you can at least be civil and, you know, understand that you're human beings with opposing points of view, which seems next to impossible these days on social media. So,
well, you have to be a lot more civil if suddenly you're seeing the person eye to eye.
Absolutely. Too.
And occasionally I've been putting a position where somebody I've mouthed off about, somebody else in the scene or whatever, and then there they are right there, including Jerry Brown once after California Uber Alice. And, you know, you have to be on your toes and be diplomatic. And in some cases, it was just as well I kept my mouth shut about some stuff over the years after X got really big, the punk band X, in a major label way, while Dead Kennedys went very much another way, more and more hardcore and rabidly DIY and growl, snarl, X or sell out this, sell out that. And I never said it publicly because we'd always been friendly and stuff, and I didn't see him for many years. And they came back and played the X songs with Billy Zoom again. And luckily, it was all very, very friendly, and they had no idea I had ever copped that attitude about them at all, which, you know, it was just as well.
Which is interesting because I just had an email exchange today with John Doe. Because because John is starring in a remake of DOA, right?
Oh my God.
Yeah.
He's got the Edmund O'Brien role.
He is playing the Edmund O'Brien, Frank Bigelow. He is Frank Bigelow in a new version of DOA.
Wow.
John, I wonder who's... John's a huge noir guy like you. See? So you
who's directing it? Any idea?
I'm embarrassed. I do know because I started watching the film earlier today. But I can't remember the guy's name. But it's in black and white, and it's a period. It's a period piece in black and white, and John is the star. And you know, also just to bring the whole punk thing kind of full cycle here. Chris D from the Flesh Eaters and Divine Horseman.
Right. And he's not the director then.
No, he is not the director. But I've known Chris for years and years, and he is a total film guy. And, you know, we met years ago, and I didn't realize that I had already. Because he worked for the American Cinematheque in Hollywood. And when I started doing my film shows there, I did not realize that the guy that I was working with was Chris D. Because I guess he wasn't in leather pants with his shirt off when I was dealing with him. So I didn't recognize him. Pardon?
That wasn't quite where he was at anyway, as a stage guy and stuff. But
well, yeah. But, you know, he's such a writer. He's such a learned writer of all of this stuff. And, you know, I've been very close to Chris for years and years. And anyway, it's funny. So there are more connections between film noir and punk rock than people might realize.
Oh, yeah. We might get into that a little later because, yeah, I'm still on almost my first page here. You went to the Art Institute. You became close and involved with George Kuchar.
Yes.
And, but then you get, do you want to talk about that at all?
It was a very interesting experience. I mean, I realize now looking back that I was a little too young, maybe which may have been a good thing. Like that whole era, that mid 70s to very early 80s era in San Francisco was, you know, punk was happening. AIDS was right around the corner. And there was a fervor, you know, there was an artistic fervor that was happening in San Francisco that I was only peripherally soaking up because I was still a teenager, you know, and there was a lot of stuff going on. It was a deep dive, the learning experience. And so a lot of my understanding of classic Hollywood kind of was filtered through George and his obsession with Hollywood movies. Like I didn't know anything about Douglas Sirk until I had met George and so my understanding of Douglas Sirk came through George's parodies of Douglas Sirk movies, right?
That being a major director.
Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And
I mean, some people listening to this are going to have no idea who Douglas Sirk was and no idea what noir is, even. We're dragging the river here. So the occasional annotation.
That's good. I love that because, I don't want to keep talking to the same people who just want to tell me what their favorite noir films are. I want to talk to people who don't know what I'm talking about, you know?
Well, speaking of which, where does George Kuchar fit in underground film?
Okay, so George Kuchar from New York with his twin brother, Mike, they were major figures in the American underground film scene of the 1960s. They were twin brothers from New York, both gay, who were obsessed with like old Hollywood. They were John Waters before John Waters ever appeared on the scene, right? So, and then George at one point, because there's no way you actually make a living making these kind of films or anything, he caught on both, and I knew both George and Mike, but George caught on at the San Francisco Art Institute as a film teacher because the Art Institute was filled with artists who needed to make money. I mean, that's what it was, right? So whether you were a painter or a sculptor or a filmmaker or a photographer, you were teaching at the Art Institute because you had to supplement your income as an artist by teaching. And George was a very interesting, in some respects, my understanding of cinema came through this weird filter, looking back through this insane prism that George had, the way he would comprehend old Hollywood, was reverential, but very satirical at the same time. And anyway, so I made films with George and, you know, and then I made my own film when I was at the Art Institute. And once that was done, I kind of used up everything there was to offer there. So I did not matriculate at the San Francisco Art Institute. I got there. I got the equipment. I soaked up what I could soak up and I made a film and I got out. It's very much like with a band, like we need the equipment, you know, we need the studio to record. And then once you do it, it's like, fine, I'm out of here now. Got what I needed.
Right. Kuchar in, you know, film legend world, it's not old Hollywood people think of when they think of him. They think more in terms of, you know, trash movies and of varying kinds. And he's not in the Incredibly Strange Films book that research put out, I don't think. But I'm thinking a lot of his contemporaries were in there, from the Ray Dennis Steckler to Frank Henenlotter and many others are in that. I kind of lump him in with them. Am I right or wrong?
Yes, although when George and Mike started making films, it really was the earliest days of completely do-it-yourself, independent, underground cinema. I mean, George predated everybody, not only John Waters, but he predated Andy Warhol. I mean, he was just this goofy kid. He and his twin brother were goofy kids in New York who were movie obsessed, who knew there was something off about them. There was no place for them to fit in. And so they just loved movies and decided we're going to make our own films. And the thing that was always astounding about George is people always assumed that George was this brilliant satirist, cartoonist, all this stuff. But there was part of George that was completely serious about what he was doing. You know, it's just like he never felt like, well, they're never going to let me make a real movie. A guy like me can't make a real movie, you know? So I'm just going to do...
And he was serious too.
Yeah, he says, I'm just going to do my things. And but George was a fantastic guy. And his ability to read people and see what mattered to them. And quite honestly, George's ability to exploit people in a way they wanted to be exploited was a huge education for me. Because, you know, if you're teaching a film class and you've got all these people who want to do things, it's like you got to convince them to do stuff that makes them, it might be uncomfortable, but you're pushing them to a place they haven't gone before. And that was what George was really, really good at. And then, you know, years later, it was really cool, Jello, because I don't think George ever quite understood, because we weren't like bonded or close in any way. You know, there was a fellow named Kurt McDowell who made films in George's class who was like his prize student. And Kurt made a film back then called Thundercrack that was like a black and white noir horror movie, porn film. It was a combination of everything. And George was in it, you know, and Kurt was going to be he was from the Midwest, but he was going to be San Francisco's answer to John Waters. And then Kurt ended up dying of AIDS. And, but all of that stuff was just really part of my formative years, let's say.
You cycled out of the Art Institute, and then somehow you probably... Although I'm guessing your parents were very encouraging with you with whatever you wanted to do and stuff. Somehow you had to go get a job or make a living or do something. And it appears in your bio that you were a working journalist for a decade and a half plus.
Correct.
Before Czar of Noir even was on the horizon or anything. So is that the direct jump from the Art Institute to writing news articles or whatever? And who did you write for? What did you write?
Pretty much. It was a fairly direct jump. I was a bartender at some point, but I did make a transition to just writing for a living because I knew it was possible. Because my dad, like when you say, how are you created? I was created because my dad was a writer who never I don't even know that my father graduated from high school, right? So, but he was a working journalist, and it always felt to me like this is something you can do. And so I just applied for a job at a trade publication. It was about the ocean shipping industry. I applied for a job at this magazine in San Francisco, and I got the job, and I was there, and then I just steadily kept doing that until it was like I was working for national magazines, and then I was like the first West Coast editor of several of these publications with a
Naval.
Well, it was weird. They were publications that no one would really know. I think they're even defunct today. But you know, distribution magazine, business logistics, all the, I wrote for a publication called Sports Travel that was about the guys who actually book all, you know, have to handle all the travel stuff for sports teams and all this. So it's classic trade journalism. It's not like I was working for the Washington Post or something, you know, but man, was that an education. I mean, it got me around the world, covering different things kind of from the inside and learning how things work for people who are involved in the business, as opposed to people who are just looking at it from a public perspective, right? So if I wrote something about a trade war with China, I was writing about it from the point of view of the people who are actually involved, rather than how does this affect you, John Q. Public, you know? I mean, and I got, you know, some pretty angry letters from some people who were like, how dare you say this? And it's, you know, Fred Smith, the head of Federal Express, wrote a very sternly worded letter one time about something that I had said about his arrogant handling of landing rights in Japan or something like that, you know? So anyway, well, it was a great education.
Yeah, it also meant that you had to learn the subject and write well and write on deadline and write quickly.
Absolutely.
Skill I wish I acquired, but I've never been able to do it. And, you know, I had to turn down Spin over the years and Harper's and more Maximum Rock and Roll on down because I'm so slow at writing prose. I gave it a try for your Noir City magazine, of course. And he chuckles. I don't think.
No, it was great. It was great. But let's face it, Jell-O, that magazine's a quarterly.
Right.
Different than writing for a daily or a weekly where you have to turn the stuff in.
The annual. Wah! I wanted that feather in this very hat. The problem was I didn't write super academically and in depth like people do for Noir City Times. I wrote, you wanted noir record albums, so I wrote them in the snappy style of the program notes for each film at Noir City and stuff, and you know, made it jump that way.
But that was exactly what we wanted. If I had known your ultimate goal was to be included in the Noir City annual, then that's a different thing, because we clearly
we
have certain things that we put in the magazine that we don't put in the annual because they are specific to the magazine. And some of the more, you know, off the beaten path stuff, like what we asked you to provide, and you know, those were never really meant to be in the annual. But we'll get around to something else, Jell-O. You can write something else, and we'll make sure it gets.
Or you can resurrect it and put it in another one. Whatever you want to do. There you go.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
But that now, back to what created you. You wrote for trade magazines. I'd love to see the FedEx thing and stuff, because a sharp-tongued columnist is always fun, sometimes even if I don't agree with them and things, including, you know, Jim Murray, the sports writer my dad liked when I was growing up. Oh, my God. He was quite hilarious. And an NFL team, the one time Washington Redskins, trades all their draft choices for all these older guys and veterans. And they did, I think, win a Super Bowl from it. Then George Allen Sr., not the right-wing governor who tried to be president, Sr. And he started referring to them as the old skins. I'm trying to think of a better example of him, because there were some really...
Jim Murray was a legend, an absolute legend in, among sports writers. And, you know, back in those days, Jello, sports writing was the best writing in the newspaper, because it wasn't so serious. You could kind of cut loose and write very creatively. And unfortunately, I think a lot of that's been lost because... you know, everything's on television now. And now it's just like, who's the biggest loudmouth who can holler?
24-hour news cycle.
Yeah. And the artistry of writing a daily column on deadline, it doesn't really exist anymore. And right. I mean, there are people who, you know, people write their blogs and all this stuff, but writing to fit a certain amount of column inches, as they called it, and having people... having that be a necessary part of the day for people, like, I have to read this guy by this time or I can't go on with my day, is pretty amazing. And my dad was one of those guys.
He wrote about boxing, right?
He wrote about boxing almost exclusively. He did write about boxing exclusively. I say almost because there was the famous story, at least in our family, of the night that the Examiner was short-staffed and they sent my father to cover a hockey game. My father had never seen a hockey game in his life. He had no interest in it whatsoever. And so he went to cover this hockey game, and the next day he filed his story, and the first line of his story was, "Thank God a fight broke out."
I'm sure you're aware that people, you know, back in the VHS video days, there was a booming trade in hockey fight footage among collectors, some of which were active players who collected them too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I confess I have a... Look, Jello, I was surprised when we were at the last Noir City Festival, at the end of one of those evenings, we were talking... and I had no idea that you were a sports fan, that you actually, you know, I don't know how closely you follow sports, but that you knew your sports. That amazed me.
I veer in and out. There was some of it as a kid because of the daily paper, and then, you know, reading Jim Murray's column, among other things, for yucks. And then the only way I could get my grandfather on my mother's side in Michigan to kind of try and ingratiate myself, I was this misfit kid. He wasn't real thrilled with weird eating habits. Then his hair is long and he's fat and junior high, blah, blah, blah. But he watched Cubs games, Chicago Cubs baseball games every single day. So I got to know them well. And the trivia was there, and needle him about his flubby cubbies and things like that. And then at home, the big religion, my father watched all kinds of sports, but the big one was the Denver Broncos, who were just horrible in those days. Yeah. You know, the worst than the Raiders ever were in the final days of Al Davis. They lost year after year after year, and Dad would get mad year after year after year. And I miss him getting mad at Bronco games like crazy, because he was gone at age 86 in, 2013. So I whether I liked it or not, there's certain areas I retain trivia up for. I'm useless with stocks and bonds or some of those kind of things, but the big ones, music, sports when I'm actually paying attention, and I guess the two big ones are music and white-collar crime.
I mean, Watergate went down in our teenage years, and I had parents who did not shield me from the bloody Vietnam War footage and violent attacks on Selma and all that as a kid, you know, and it was discussed intelligently. Thus, I had very passionate opinions about these things. Mm-hmm. And so that always kind of retained some of that and stuff. And then kind of started zeroing back in on the Giants around the turn of our current century. And then players we had been familiar with for several years, suddenly they got in the World Series while I was on tour in Europe and missed the heartbreak of that one. But so I pay attention. I'm hoping we get Gabe Kapler on Renegade Roundtable, the Giants manager, at some point, because he's not just a, you know, an old baseball salt who's been nothing but a jock. And if he has opinions at all, they're probably very conservative. And that's not Gabe Kapler at all.
No.
Deep thinker on many, many other subjects, and kneeled with his players when the 2020 season finally began. And last year, he wouldn't come out for the national anthem after yet another round of police violence and stuff. And he couldn't take it anymore and said so. So,
he seems like a pretty interesting and very eloquent speaker, actually. I like listening to his pregame talks, because he actually makes a lot of sense about stuff, and he seems like a pretty cool guy. I have a lot of friends in Philadelphia, and you know, he coached in Philadelphia before he came out here, and they hated him. I think they hated him for the very reasons that he is a perfect fit in San Francisco.
And it's not as though they lost a ton of games under him all of a sudden or anything, was it?
No, I think it was just something about his personal style and his approach to the game that, you know, Philadelphia sports fans are the most hardcore conservative kind of sports fans in the world. And they had no use for his, let's face it, he has a very California style when it comes to dealing with his players and everything. And I don't think they had any use for that in Philadelphia. So
Philadelphia, to me, is the most fascinatingly horrible city I've been to in this entire country. Not my least favorite. I mean, there's some that are just so badly designed and flying, but like Houston and St. Louis that are just like, I know good people in both, and there's some great stuff. But overall, oh my God, you know, if Scott Wiener, the state senator here, gets his way and there's no more zoning laws, we're going to get Houston, Texas for the whole state, or Jacksonville, Florida. No zoning at all. And it's just, you know, it's not a good way to have a city. More on that some other time, perhaps. But Philadelphia, on the other hand, is just so warped and stuff.
I like Philadelphia very much. I've always enjoyed the time I've spent there. But I'm aware of, you know, it's a tough town. Philadelphia is a very tough town.
I mean, friends I have there even called, hey, hi, Jello, welcome to Hostile City.
The city of brotherly love.
Oh, yeah. Well, at some point, you weren't just writing for trade mags and started maybe to, I guess I'm going to jump next because I don't know where else to go, and what created you with your early books. You know, you have written both nonfiction books and even two novels now as well, but the early stuff is not about film noir. Kuchar, and coming up through him, kind of fills in the blanks here, because the first book I know of, it's not about noir. It's called Grindhouse, The Forbidden World of Adults Only Cinema, and then on top of cinemas, plural, and then a VHS only documentary you co-wrote and co-produced called Mau Mau Sex Sex. Yes. And then another book called Go Crazy, The Origin of American Outlaw Cinema. I've never seen that one.
I gotta get you a copy of that. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
But how to explain all of this. So Grindhouse was, so years ago when I was living in San Francisco, I had a very good friend of mine. We made films together when I was at the Art Institute and he was at San Francisco State University. His name was Fred Klein. And Fred's dad was a film distributor, Mel Klein's Super Films. And Fred was a projectionist in San Francisco. He got in the projectionist union. And one night he called me up and said, you got to come down here to the, I think it was the Center Theater, which was a porn house at that point. And he said, I'm projecting down here, but I found something that you need to come take a look at. And so I went down there, and in the basement of this incredible theater. Do you know this place on Market Street in San Francisco? I think the theater is still there. I don't know what it is now, but it was the Center Theater, C-E-N-T-R-E.
And not the Cento Cedar.
No. That was over in, I've been to the Cento Cedar, which was, you know, you'd go out the back door and you could go get fish and chips at the Edinburgh Castle down the street from the Cento Cedar and all that. It was a fabulous place. But the Center Theater was right on Market Street. It had been like a grindhouse newsreel theater in the 30s and 40s, but also like an exploitation house. And in the basement were decades of material from these movies that I knew nothing about. And so we stole it all. We just, you know, I brought my mom's car. And he said, because that was it. When Fred said, come down here and visit me, he said, and bring your mother's car. I didn't even have a car at that time, but he knew that my mom had this big old Chevy with a huge trunk, you know? And so we stole all this stuff out of the basement of the theater. That material became the basis for my first book, Grindhouse, because it opened up a world of dirty movies to me that were made all the way back from like the early 1930s. On into the 1960s. And so just having to educate myself about what is this stuff, where did this all come from, that's what my first book was all about.
Aha. Uh-huh. And somehow you vaulted from that into noir scholarship, czar of noir, and more from there. So after Gun Crazy, the Origin of American Outlaw Cinema, the Mau Mau Sex, and the rest, how did that put you on a path for your deep dive into noir? I'm assuming you were a voracious reader from early on, too.
I was. Always a reader. And I just felt at a certain point, like my goal in life was to write a novel. That was my goal in life. And I remember when my dad was working at the paper, he got a book sent to him called Fat City by a guy named Leonard Gardner, a young writer. Leonard was 29 at that point, and he had written this book that was a boxing novel. My dad never did anything with it. He just brought it. My dad used to always bring stuff home for me and like give it to me, like sports photos. And, you know, back then the newspaper was the coolest place in the world, right? I mean, it was the nerve center of the American city. And the fact that my dad would bring me stuff, you know, off the wire, or, you know, his original drafts of his columns that my dad would type on a roll of paper in the typewriter so that he didn't have to change the paper. He would just write his columns in one long sheet. And then he'd send them to the kid would take him to the copy editor and everything. And this, he'd bring the originals home to me, which I still have dozens and dozens and dozens of these. And
one more project way on a back burner is the collected writings of Eddie Muller Sr.
Yeah, I mean, I've actually had a lot of people inquire about that. Anyway, so all of that stuff was just super interesting to me. And then making the transition to the noir guy was just after I'd written Grindhouse, I was now a published author. And my editor, Gordon Van Gelder, who was the related to Rudy Van Gelder, who is famous as a jazz guy on the East Coast. He did a lot of stuff for Blue Note, the Blue Note label and everything. Rudy Van Gelder produced a lot of very important jazz musicians. And anyway, Gordon said to me, so what do you want to do as a follow-up? We'll buy your next book. And that's when I just said, well, I want to write a book about film noir. which I loved, but I didn't really know that much about it. So I made that research project, you know, I got paid to do all this research about film noir and wrote my initial book on the subject, Dark City, The Lost World of Film Noir. And that, Jello, basically that started the whole thing, because the book came out and there were still a number of people alive who I referenced in the book, who I ended up meeting, Bud Bedeker, Andre de Toth, a bunch of the actresses who were in these films. And I got to program film festivals, first for the American Cinematheque in Hollywood, and then at the Castro Theater here in San Francisco in 2003. And it just took off. And all of a sudden I was like a lightning rod for the people who love this stuff, because I was doing, you know, film shows that everybody could come and share their enthusiasm for these movies.
Was Noir City your first festival, or did you do stuff in the Cinematheque or someplace in LA earlier?
No, I did stuff in LA earlier. I can't remember how long, two or three years in LA. And that was fantastic because a lot of the people who made the films were still living and they were in LA. And so they came out as guests of the festival. Like the first year we did the festival, I remember women outlive men. So it's just the fact of the matter. So there were all these women, Audrey Totter, Evelyn Keyes, Jane Greer, Marie Windsor, Jan Sterling, all of these actresses were still around and came out and appeared with the movies. But then we also had writers, the few surviving directors who were around. It was fantastic. And then out of that, Anita Manga, who was programming at the Castro, saw what I was doing in LA and invited me to do an even bigger festival at the Castro. And that's when I called it Noir City.
And by then, through the connections in LA, I assume you were already able to somehow worm your way into the good graces sort of studio bosses or the people who would actually let you into their vaults and look for 35 millimeter prints of movies they denied even existed and finding them.
Correct. Correct. It wasn't that they denied they existed. They just weren't that aware. And that wasn't all the studio people, but that was certainly the case at times. Was like, so, and it took several years. You know, it wasn't an overnight thing. It's like we had to show that, like, there were audiences for this. And then it's like, wow, they're asking for more of this stuff. And then, quite honestly, it was just, who are these people? And when we asked, can we come on the lot? Can we come to the studio and visit you and talk about this? They were completely thrilled because these are people who, by and large, work in total anonymity. You know, no, even their bosses, the people who sign their paychecks, don't know who they are or what they do. So the fact that somebody wanted to come on the lot and talk to them about this stuff and like how they preserve the material or don't was really intriguing. And then it's just, Jello, this goes right back to what we were saying at the top. It makes all the difference in the world when you actually meet somebody face to face and look them in the eye and talk to them about something instead of it just being an email or something like that. So the fact that I could meet people like Grover Crisp at Sony or Bob O'Neill at Universal or Sean Belston at 20th Century Fox, it was just like, you know, let's talk about this. What's your favorite movie? Blah, blah, blah. And it's like, you know, I can get a bunch of plays out of a film that nobody else knows anything about. I can do that. And over the years, they really came to respect me because it was like, wow, here's a movie that nobody's even heard of. And Eddie's actually getting an audience to pay money to come and see this. And it's 65 or 70 years old. And nobody knows what it is.
There's video and DVD sales to be had.
Well, Yes, that is definitely true. Although I quickly learned that, you know, there's a huge disparity between what the bosses think is success and profitability and what
right.
a normal person right. thinks is profitable,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Like I remember going to Paramount and saying, you know, you guys have a bunch of old noir films that I don't even think you're aware of what you have. And I could do something with these. And they said, well, how many units do you think you'll be able to sell? And I said, optimistically, like maybe 10,000. And it was like, eh, too bad. If you'd said 100,000, we might have had a conversation here, you know? And which is, to me, is absurd, because 10,000 units of something is tremendous in this day and age. If you can sell 10,000 units of an old movie, that's spectacular. There's no way, like, they look at me like, you're nuts if you think that means something. And I look at them and I say, you're nuts if you think you're going to sell 100,000 copies.
Unfortunately, the film industry and the music industry, among others, have often been swallowed by the same predatory corporations, thanks to deregulating the takeover laws with Reagan and all. And they're not run by fans. They might as well be selling insecticide. They don't care. Then their whole thing for both is, we'll lose gazillions of dollars on 5 blockbusters in hopes we make all this money back on the 6th blockbusters. We will try to launch dozens of Justin Biebers or Britney Spearses or Rihannas or whatever and hope that we make all the money back on one and then forget about the rest of them. The hell with them. And anything else, like A&M Records nurturing an artist for half a dozen albums before they break or something because they believed it and they liked it. Warner's was good for that too. That is gone. And on that cheerful note, we have come to the end of our one-hour podcast-a-saurus thing. Get ready later on, folks, for part 2. And until then, go get some popcorn, hit your flask outside, smoke your damn tobacco if you must, although that's kind of film noir for all the wrong reasons, and we will be back.